I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and what's next. It's a show that asks questions and peels back the layers of our average everyday experience and goes beyond scratching the surface. We interview people doing incredible things who are making a difference around the globe. Join me as we listen in and get one step closer to understanding that big ideas shared create collaboration. Collaboration can inspire community, and communities create social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
So my next two guests are Barry Cohen and Brian Logie, and we talk about the new film, Unloved, Huronia's Forgotten Children. This is a powerful and compelling film. This is the kind of movie, this is the kind of story that everyone needs to see. Let me just read this two-sentence statement here about the film. Quote, "For more than a century, a horrific Ontario institution ruined lives. A filmmaker on a personal quest gives survivors a voice." Close quote. This is a very personal, very intimate, very gripping film by Barry Cohen about Huronia, and more importantly, about the people who were there. And this is a film about institutionalization. It's about oppression. It's about principalities. It's about power. It's about stepping into a part of our past here in Ontario that none of us, many of us, I'm going to say, didn't really know much about, and seeing the details play out in this story and through these people's lives is really quite a horrific, and it's kind of terrifying, really. And it's one of those stories where you think, if a portion of this is true, wow, where and how did we go so wrong? This is the kind of film that's going to resonate around the world. I think there's a global message here. I think this is not just for Canadians and not for just Ontarians, that's for sure. But I think cultures all over the world will be able to take lessons away from this and learn many, many things, not only about how to be better humans, but about how to provide better care for others. So stay tuned. Currently, you can see it on CBC Gem here in Canada. And it was at Hot Docs last year and did very well. And it's a film that again, it touches on some very personal and very intimate issues. We talk a lot about wood carving, and you're going to hear a little bit more about that. And Brian, it turns out Brian is quite the craftsman. He is a cabinet maker. He's a sculptor of a certain kind. And we talk about a carving that he's made. And I think you're going to get a real kick out of the work that he does. As I said before, this is a film about, you know, oppression and power and institutions, and about what not to do, and about sort of those darker places, I guess you could say, in human nature. We talk about therapy, we talk about junk science, and we get into eugenics a little bit, and we talk about this idea of othering somebody, and what does that actually mean, and how does that dehumanize? How does that take away from the person and who they really are? We talk about capitalism and about something, a really beautiful phrase. We talk about conditions of possibility, you know, what could be. This is a film about memory. It's about trauma. It's about pain. It's about the past. It's about family. It's about, I mean, so many things. Barry has made a very layered and important film. RememberEveryName.com is one of the websites that you want to visit, and the other is unloved.com. You can find more information about that. And both of those websites will become more meaningful to you once you've certainly heard the interview, but also seen the film. So again, CBC Gem, you'll find out more about the film there and be able to watch it. Don't forget davidpecklive.com for more information about my writing and speaking and podcasting. It's all there. You can buy a copy of Real Change is Incremental. More importantly, though, please, you know, wherever you're listening to podcasts, subscribe to Face to Face, and please leave us a review. If you're listening / watching on YouTube, give us a thumbs up, subscribe to the channel. But again, more importantly, leave us a review. We would so appreciate it. Stay tuned for a compelling conversation with Barry Cohen and Brian Logie. My name's David Peck, and you're listening to Face to Face. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We are joined by two very special guests here with us today to talk about a beautiful and brilliant and disturbing film called Unloved, Huronia's Forgotten Children. Writer, director, producer, storyteller Barry Cohen is here with us, and survivor Brian Logie here on Face to Face today to chat about this new and important film. Brian, Barry, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Barry, I guess, you know, the film's opening up online very soon. Let's talk about that. It's going to be on CBC Gem. People are going to be able to get to it through the platform. So check it out there. The film is called Unloved. Can you, I guess, maybe you don't want to give too much away, but I suppose it really is kind of a detective story that you've put together here. I mean, you really do, you could almost call it uncovered in a sense, but Unloved is so much more apropos, it seems to me. And by the way, before you step into an answer of any kind, congratulations. Can I say that I love this film?
By all means. I know it's not an easy film to love. I hope people love the characters, or, you know, the storytellers and the heroes who survived unspeakable harm as children. And as we know, when you suffer harm as children, it carries through into your life. And so I'm eternally grateful to, you know, the storytellers and my own family who shared their experiences and their histories and stories with us. But yes, I'll take that. Yes, you can.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is.
Embraced it for sure.
Yeah, it's a film that needs to be seen. It's the kind of film that needs to be written about and talked about around the dinner table. And I hope and trust students are going to write about it and perhaps uncover more stories. And I think there's an intimacy to it that makes it so relevant on so many levels. Barry, can you tell us a little bit about how you were, I guess, first introduced into this story, and maybe that, oh, wow, you know what? I have to make a film about this.
Right. Well, first, I just want to say it's also going to be on the CBC main television network on Sunday 29th at 8 p.m. So that's kind of the television broadcast.
Jan 29th, 8 p.m. CBC.
Yeah, thank you. So it happened, my sister, who is from my dad's first marriage, and my sister Adele called me one day and said, hey, did you hear about this class action lawsuit that got settled? So this was in late 2013, almost 10 years ago now, nine years ago, because I think the settlement was in December 2013 when it was finally approved by a judge. And I said, I didn't understand what she was saying. What are you talking about? She said, oh, about Aurelia. About, you know, that place where Alfie was. Okay, so Alfie was our brother, who I never knew, from my dad's first marriage, her brother. All I knew at that point in 2013 was that I had a brother who I never knew, who had been sent as a small child to this hospital. I didn't even know its name. All I knew was Aurelia, this hospital in Aurelia. And I said, well, what's going on? And she said, well, it was an awful place. They hurt children and the residents. So find out. And later on, and this is in the film, we discover that, in fact, another brother that I had, Adele's other brother, Lewis, was also there. But my dad never told us that.
Wow.
And he took that to his grave. And in the course of researching the film and making the film, I discovered that he had been there, too. But the aha moment was pretty much that night, because I immediately went to my computer and I looked up It was in the newspaper. So I looked up the newspaper online, and then I found the name of the law firm, Kosky Minsky. I went onto their website and I read, and they had a bunch of documents publicly available online at that point. And it had the statement of the plaintiff's statement of, right. of claim, all, and it was this big document, like 75, 80 pages.
Right. Yeah,
and I just devoured it that night, and I was floored. I was shaking with, and it was such a an incredible statement, very well researched, detailed, based on tons of interviews, because they were ready to go to trial. That this was part of their prep going to trial. Well, it didn't happen. And that's a whole other story we get into about class action, the flaw in class action law in Canada. But I read this and I went, I bet you nobody knows this exists, that this existed, and that probably kind of still exists, but I bet you nobody knew this.
Nobody knows. And if they do know about it, they certainly don't know.
They didn't know about these institutions. They didn't know that these harms were going on, that they had been documented for many, many, many years, that there had been government inquiries, that there had been media reports, and nobody did, you know, nobody did anything. And I was furious, and I thought, I've got to do something about it. I've got to do something. And so I met with Adele, my sister, and I said, I can't do this without you, because it's about your brothers too. And you're the one who remembers them even a little bit. And is it okay though? It was a big ask, because it's very wounding, a lot of pain.
Sure.
And I said, but think about it. And she didn't think about it. She said, yes, absolutely. I said, oh, no, still think about it.
Right.
And she did. And then she said, yeah, let's do this. And I said, well, let me find out about it. And then as time went on and I connected up with the litigation guardians, Marilyn and Jim Dolmash, they were able to share with me that there were site tours of the buildings arranged as part of the class action prompt. One of the promises was people could go to the buildings, survivors and families and supporters. So Adele wanted to go. And that's when I took my camera for the first time.
That was the first time.
Yeah. And that was in, I think, May or June 2014.
Brian, I want to ask you how you're involved with this story for our listeners. They probably have not seen this film yet, but we're certainly going to hope that they get to see this in the very near future. Tell us a little bit about your story and how you're connected to Barry. And did you get a phone call from Barry? Was that what it was?
No, I met Barry there on site.
Wow. Okay.
So, and
well, there's something really beautiful about that.
Well, it was different. I was horrified of being in that place.
Mm.
Nobody really cared until Barry came along. It was like people were saying, well, it isn't true. They don't do this thing. They never done this thing. So in other words, they're taking a look at me now. They say, well, listen, this thing that Brian told us before, it has to be true, because now there's a movie on it. So she actually made everybody aware of what was going on in there, which is close to my heart now. I mean, I'm beside myself in this movie. I mean, it was incredible. The only bad thing I got about the whole thing is I never had the chance to point out that it was him, her, and her that did this to us.
Yeah, Brian, there's one point in the movie where you're chatting, I think you're being interviewed, and it sounded to me like you wanted accountability. I mean,
yes, sir.
Right? And I think most of us would want that, right?
Like, yes.
You need to pay for what you did. We need to uncover this even further. Is that fair?
That's fair. Yes. I mean, I never had any way to say, okay, somebody says, okay, that we're sorry that this happened to you. It just never been. It just never was. I mean, and then once I get out of that place, I was only in there for 3 years. So the 3 years, then my parent, I guess my parent at that time took me out, and then I was out in the road. I was out in the street.
Wow.
So therefore, I mean, I don't read or write. I don't call a block, but I'm good at what I do when I get a piece of wood in my hand.
Right.
Brian's a very talented artist.
Well, I got I
among
got
other that. Talents. Yeah.
That comes out very, very, I think, very nicely. I could, I think you're, are you planing a piece of wood in the film, Brian? I could feel the warm, warm wood on my hands. I took wood shopping.
I seem to have any chance I get a piece of wood in my hand, I seem to head to the shop and see what I can make with it.
Oh, that's amazing. What do you make? What do you make with wood? I mean, do you carve? Is it furniture?
Yeah, I do a lot of carving. I can't remember where I put it. I'd like to show you what I just finished.
Yeah, I would like to see that. And who knows?
I mean, 200 pieces.
200 pieces sounds like several chess sets. Give us a bit of an overview of the film and take us through it.
So the film is about a place, and it's also about a state of mind in a way too, with certainly the government's state of mind about how they treated children labeled and or diagnosed as developmentally challenged or delayed. And much like most nations in the Western world, and I didn't research other nations or other developing nations, what they do, but in for the most part of the 20th century, they created institutions and residential hospitals, schools, they called them, where parents were compelled in many cases, or the Children's Aid Society dropped kids off, to send their children, even as young as infants and toddlers, to be in these institutions, separated from their families. Children's Aid often used them as dumping grounds for wayward children or children they couldn't foster out, or children who were come from challenging families or broken families, or parents who were may have had mental illnesses of their own and couldn't take care of their kids. If the Children's Aid got a hold of them and couldn't find placements for them, they were with no diagnosis properly.
Right.
In some cases.
Well, one of the alarming things for me that came up in the film was that in some cases it was, I think the phrase was, that for immediate care, it was used as a place to say, we can't afford to take care of our kids, therefore we're going to move them on to this, you know, institution.
Well, in some cases, yes, that's true. But that's because in those days, and which days am I talking about? Pretty much, you know, I mean, we're talking throughout the 20th century, but primarily the focus of my film is from the 50s and 60s, 70s. There were no supports in the community. There was no direct funding for parents. There was no, developmental services in the community. There was no inclusion classes in schoolrooms, in classrooms, in schools, and that they didn't happen until the late 60s, 70s. I mean, I grew up at a time when we had more integrated education, where there were kids of different levels in a classroom. Or next door to my classroom, there would be a separate classroom, what they called special ed. Not great, but at least it was in the classroom and the kids got to go home and be with their families. That didn't really happen. It didn't happen for my brothers. So, but what did happen was these overcrowded, faraway institutions where kids were kind of, you know, locked away and forgotten, mistreated. There was no oversight. There was emotional, sexual, physical abuse on a recurring basis, a very stressful environment, and no empathy or love for these children, and no properly trained staff, no properly trained, I would say, therapists. I think, you know, they got social workers more involved as the 60s rolled on, and maybe they did, you know, more better things in the 70s and 80s. But I met staff members who worked at these facilities, and there were three main ones in Ontario, but there were smaller satellite ones too. And the staff, and one of whom was Debbie Vernon, who's in the film. Debbie worked there in the 70s, and then she came back and 20, worked there in the 90s.
25 years later.
Yeah, same. She
and
said,
she
it was
said
the
nothing
same.
Changed.
Nothing really changed. And so, you know, whether it was the quality of the clothing, the food, the sanitation, the way staff were speaking to people, and how they were handled, how they were encouraged to be the best they could be. It wasn't great. But the whole idea of an institution and separating kids off, I understand that there may be some beings in the world who are very, very different, who come into the world with a lot of challenges and very different, or through accidents or what happens, or brain injuries, can have a lot of challenges. And I don't know that we really explored that we're doing the best by just putting them away somewhere. And whether that's even the most economical thing to do, let alone the best emotional thing to do, if we gave people direct funding. I know that the autism community, you know, the families have been, since the Ford government came in Ontario, you know, have been fighting for more and direct funding to support their kids at home. And it just kind of stymies me that we're not having a bigger, larger conversation around this.
Around it, yeah, which I would imagine is one of the many things that you're hoping the film will do. And you know,
I am. And I also want to generate conversations about long-term care, sure, as well.
And what,
which,
yeah,
we know,
what,
turned out to, it blew up in our face during COVID, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Brian, you said, you know, when you mentioned that you were there for 3 years, it sounded like you were sort of saying, oh, it was only 3 years. But it seems to me that 3 years was one day too long in this case. I mean, I guess some other patients were there for many, many years.
Oh, yes. Yes. And the only reason why I was there for the 3 years, it wasn't even my parents that came and get my mother that came and get me. It was her boyfriend that came and got me. And all I was doing is just put in a room. I think I was about 12. Then they got rid of me at 12. And I lived out in the street. But then, you know, like I say, you don't know what destiny holds. Now, I own everything I have now. I own a couple of homes and stuff like this. I did okay. Others didn't do as well. But the anger in me is still there. And if people say time, you'll forget, that's hogwash. You never forget. I still have it in my mind. I still remember every room I've ever been taken to. I can describe that thing to a T. And just that still bothers me. But you know something? Eventually it'll go away after I'm not here no more.
Brian, how do you
Can I ask Brian a question?
Yeah, sure. Go.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Go ahead, Mary.
So, Brian, did it when you tell your story, and when you told your story in the film, and when you tell your story to other people, how does that feel for you?
A relief. That somebody else is listening to me, that maybe they're concerned, maybe it did happen. I was hoping maybe somebody could say, yeah, Brian, I really believe that this did that happen. Most of the time when you tell people, they say, well, you know, I don't know, you know, until they see a movie and say this is a true documentary, then they take a look and they say, hey, I've had so many people call me and say, Brian, you know, I apologize. I didn't believe you before. Wow. Even my own lawyer did it. Vern Silverman.
Yeah.
We were going to start a class action lawsuit against Aurelia in 1990. They wouldn't accept it. They wouldn't even hear me. But Brian, all of a sudden the two girls got involved and I guess I went with them. I should never have went. I wish I had a win on my own, but it's okay.
Well, that's a good point, because it's so what you're hearing, David, also, and this goes back to the 1950s when there was an Indigenous boy who was killed and everybody closed ranks around the staff member. Oh, it was a he injured himself. It wasn't anybody's fault. They even had an inquiry. I could have done a whole half hour just on that story.
There had been
an inquiry. There was an Indigenous boy who was brought down at 17, possibly had mental health issues. From Moose Factory, and he got into a fight with a guy who was later to be spoken of as a very shall we say challenging staff member who was really tough with the kids. I should point out that what happened after the war, by the way, is they hired a lot of veterans, probably not well trained, who, why would you put veterans who probably had PTSD in charge of children? Let alone children who may or may not.
There's so many levels to the story that are just broken. You know, I was interviewing somebody recently, and Gabor Maté. I don't know if you know
that name,
but tons of work on trauma and so on. And somebody says, "Oh, well, you know, the system was broken." And then he interrupts them and says, "Yeah, that assumes that it was ever functioning properly and well in the first place."
That was in my friend Karen Wookie's film.
There you go. Exactly right. Yeah,
her film about Bill Cosby.
Absolutely.
And those women who suffered.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just that assumption, right? It just shows you how deep the dysfunction goes.
And with that story, just like Brian was saying about being believed, so that boy died in the same year my brother died, I believe. I think it was 1956. It was either the year he died or the year he came in. I can't remember now. But it wasn't until 40 years later, even after an inquiry that hushed it up in the 1950s, 40 years later, survivors came forward and said, this happened.
Hmm.
We saw it. The guy beat the living bejesus out of this kid. He died of a severed liver or something. And then the OPP got involved and charged the fellow. He never went to trial because he died before his trial of a heart attack. So is that karma? It was certainly not justice delivered to the boy and his Albert Morrison, his name was, and his family. So that's, you know, there's a closing of ranks that happens. So in Brian's case, trying to, you know, raise a charge and sue in the early 1990s. I'm sad to say I'm not surprised, but I'm just pure, you know, I'm sad about it. But the weight of evidence, which is what Marilyn and Jim heard when they started talking to people, and they thought, these are people who haven't talked to each other in years and all their stories are similar. There's got to be something
there's
here.
There's something else going on.
And that's
on
what here. Raised it to the level of a class action.
It's class action. Brian, you say you still have the anger, you never forget. I think that comes out in the film as well. What do you do? I mean, I guess your woodwork. That's you. You create. You is that almost like a form of therapy for you?
I call it a timeout. Where my mind is only thinking on the item that I'm trying to deal with right now. I mean, I have a lot going on in my backyard and I continuously busy. So I don't have to think of this. I mean, I wish it would go away. I wish somebody, some psychiatrist someplace can say, okay, Brian, I can pluck it out of your mind and then please do it. Mm. I'd rather it forgotten, but now nobody's going to forget. She made a beautiful movie and now the graveyard is finished, which makes me happy that the people that didn't make it out of there have a place to rest, to know that they know that we did our best to make it understandable that they were victims too, as well as I am. But, other than that, no, there's, it doesn't go, ever go away.
Thanks, Brian, and thanks for just being courageous enough even to have this conversation with me and with Barry today, and for being a part of this film and for telling your story, because it is important. It's important that I hear it and that my kids hear it and students hear it all over, not just in Canada but all over the world. I think there's many stories like yours, and
it's funny how it goes. My kids, I have 5 children. And some of them are psychologists. And they said to me, Dad, I really don't want to read the book. I don't want to think anything other than what I know now. And that was okay. I can understand that. They don't want to be thinking anything less of her dad. You know, like they don't want to hear that her dad was raped or beaten, sodomized, whatever else. But it's okay. I understand that. And I never let them read the book or anything. So well, I kept them.
Brian and Barry, I mean, Barry, in your research, Brian, in your telling of your story, there's a part of us we don't want to know that it's true. We don't want to believe that it's true, right? Mm-hmm. So we see a film like this, we hear a story like this, we listen to an interview like this, and it's almost like a defense mechanism. I mean, yeah. Barry, is this your sense? I mean, because you ask some pretty big philosophical questions near the end of the film, and you know, you're talking about not reform but care, and just sort of as you move into the remember every name. But what were the forces at work, you know, that got us to this place in the first, place? How did we arrive here? How did we create these types of institutions that were so intentionally built to keep people down and to keep people marginalized. Mm-hmm. It's mind-boggling. How did anyone ever think this was a good idea? Right.
That's
for me. What do you have a sense? Do you have an answer for that on some
level? Well, I think that there's part of my answer is about human nature, and part of it is about ideas that took hold that people thought were good ideas.
Right.
So one thing I think about human nature is that I think we have a bad habit of distancing ourselves from people who we see as different, whether they're different or not, whatever that means. I think in human evolution, we have a long way to go into recognizing and loving difference in ways that benefits us all. But I think that human nature categorizes and likes to separate off, like there's a tribal part of us is
sure.
what I'm saying.
Yeah.
We right. get very tribal. And when we do that, and as a Jew, I can tell you, given Holocaust history in my culture, that when we've learned from the Holocaust, when you other somebody, when you see somebody as other and you dehumanize them and you think that they're less than human, or like when you like I kept imagining children like my brothers and their cries maybe for their parents were not considered cries for their parents, maybe that they I think the institution staff probably told themselves, well, these kids are different. They don't feel pain the way you and I feel pain at losing our parents. This is what I think the lie they told themselves so they could get through their day. What is that doing? That's dehumanizing. So when you dehumanize people, you can do anything.
You can do anything. When you turn them into a number, basically.
You turn them into a number. You turn them into something that doesn't feel the way, quote unquote, you and I feel. So there's that tribal aspect. But I think what comes out in the film too, which I tried to point out through Madeleine Burkhardt's work, is that the 19th century ideas about productivity and about capitalism, who was a productive citizen and who wasn't.
Sure.
That fed into tribal ideas as well. And once that happened, then there was a sense in which, oh, well, you know, kids who have developmental challenges, how do we make them productive? Can they be productive? If they can't, then who are they? What are they?
It's hard to watch, Barry. It's hard to watch some of that old footage, you know, some of those films that the Canadian government made, listening to John Kennedy speaking, right? Bobby Kennedy. You know, it's the time, you know, there's a certain amount of, historical slack that you cut some folks, I suppose, in these types of situations.
But clip, by the way, from Kennedy is he's disgusted at the snake pit. He calls it a snake pit.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. But I guess I'm just referring to the language even, you know, and seeing how the language has shifted from then till now and how much farther we still have to go with respect to all these things. I think I don't know if it was it Kate who brought this up, but the idea of that, you know, these places were designed by people in power.
Maryland.
Maryland. And I just find that really interesting. And it's not just interesting. I think it's revealing. And, you know, and I love that your film is about so many things. It's about people. It's about story. It's about the power of personal story. And Brian, I mean, it is about that as well. But you get into, you know, junk science, you get into eugenics, you get into history, you get into architecture and how important that is. I mean, can you talk a little bit about that idea? Because we got to wrap it up soon, but that idea about an unlovable space. It's just, first of all, it appeals to me as an academic, but boy, there's a lot of practical reality and value to that
notion. Well, maybe Brian, you know, was there anything lovable about any of those spaces there?
I thought that we were less than human. I mean, we were considered that when we were doing anything to sit up against the wall and be quiet while they played cribbage. A lot of kids rocked, you know, back and forth. But no, there was no construction of anything. There was no nothing. And basically we were in nightgowns. You know, we didn't have any clothes, no socks, no underwear, no t-shirts, just a full out nightgown. And that's what they pretty well dressed us in.
Were there playrooms?
No. Usually the playrooms were a small skinny corridor, but they took them down off the building now. They took them completely off the side of the building, and they called them the playrooms because I've been there a couple of times with a couple of staff.
The only thing that I heard from survivors was that sometimes school would be okay. What was school like?
It didn't do me no good.
Cards were good report cards.
Then tell me how come I can't read or write.
Good point.
But you know something? I'm a survivor. I can survive just about anything right now. You've seen the things I build.
Yeah.
So there's nothing that I cannot do. It's just the only thing is maybe God's being merciful to you people. Maybe if he taught me how to read or write, you'd be in big trouble. Because I could do so much with my hands. I mean, each one of these squares are 15 cuts on a saw.
Yeah.
And that's perfectly round. It's perfectly.
It sure is.
Well, it's a mathematical mind in there somewhere.
That is for sure. Yes, yeah. A puzzle solver without a doubt.
And when it comes to stuff like that, I do okay.
Yeah,
I do
I would
okay.
Say so.
But other reading and writing doesn't do me any good at all. It's usually I taught myself body language. When I approach somebody and talk to him, if I find out anything whatsoever, then I back off.
Mm.
Because then I know they don't want the conversation, or they just just don't have no time for me. So I don't use up here. I usually stay up here and I usually figure out what I'm going to do next. Right now, my hands are tied because it's winter and it's a lot of snow up here today, but I'm getting sick of the winter. Yeah. I think I might just decide to call my baby sister, tell her to send me a plane ticket and come up. I want to go down.
Go traveling.
Head south. I'm with you. I'm with you. Barry, as we wrap up.
Yeah, here, I just wanted
to just chat a little bit about where we're heading with, or where you're heading with this story. And
yeah, I mean, the only thing I was going to say about the unlovable space.
Yes, yeah, please.
And this is links into it was built by power because the place was built for the staff.
Right.
The place was built to manage.
Such a good point. Yeah.
The population. The place was not built, and these places are not built, just like long-term care rarely are built for the people who have to live there. And the children who have to live there, or the seniors who have to live there, or people who are chronically ill who have to live there. It's not typically, anyway, throughout the 20th century, these things were not built for other people in mind, for the actual residents in mind. They were built for the staff. They're built for efficiency. They're built for, you know, on an austerity model.
Sure.
Yep. And all the things that Kate Rossiter talked about in the film, that what are the conditions of possibility? They have to be far away. It's a despised population. It's staff who have, you know, too much involvement in the managing of their feeding or bodies that allows them to blur boundaries and
proximity and so on.
Yeah, these are austere places. These are places that are not welcoming to the families and so on. So those are the things that make these institutions possible. And I think that people and your listeners should remember this when they hear about the growth of new long-term care facilities, and they need to ask, who's running them? Are they being run for profit? That sounds kind of whacked out for me. Are they being run for the staff? How are they being run and why are they being run? Who has a say in what they're going to be like? And the people who are there, are they going to be there of their own free will, or are they being, you know, like, are they shunted into these places?
Well, and it's prisons. Who are prisons designed for, right? And I know there's a Eastern European philosopher, I can't think of his name right now, who says you can tell a lot about a country, a government, a people by the way they treat their prisoners. And I would think that same thinker would say the way you treat your children, or the way you treat your children that I guess have been discarded. Now what do you do? Now what do you do with that, right? And I think that somebody says that in the film, right? They were sort of taught that they were not worth anything. They weren't really people. They weren't really human, and that they were something that could be discarded. And that's just
Marie Slark says it. It's appalling. Said we were treated like appalling. Animals.
Yeah, treated like animals. It's appalling. And the architecture pushes that on them as well. Yeah, go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, you hit the head right on the nail.
Hmm.
I've heard that so many times that it's not funny.
Wow.
Yeah.
That I was there for their convenience, not there for me. But I don't know. I mean, hopefully all good will come to this. But this is not the only place. I mentioned to Barry one time when they closed it down in 2000, I think it was 2009. Well, when I moved up here to Campbellford, I didn't realize where these people went. Well, I realize it now because down the street from me, they have a fenced-in community. And I happened to go in there. I wanted to know what this fence was for. Well, they didn't have to take too long. There was adults in there. I mean, adults that were at my place.
Was it a group home, Brian?
Yeah, but it had a big, huge fence. I mean, it had to be 12-foot fence, barbed wire going into the inside.
Well, that's a good place to think of, to end, maybe, also, is because it's to remind people that there are still institutions, and we don't call them institutions. They're called group homes or, you know, residential communities.
Long-term care facilities.
The long-term care facilities.
Yeah, yeah. The language. Something else that came up for me, Barry, is just how important language is and how important it is to ask these deeper questions about all. Barry, is there a website people can go to find out a little bit more about the film as well?
There are two websites. One that survivors helped to put together called RememberEveryName.com, and they're the ones who pushed for that monument.
That's right.
And then when the film finished in the last few years, there's been these beautiful benches that now have been put in the last year that Brian and I were talking about going up and having a look at them so that people could come and actually rest and sit and be in that space. To really complete the whole cemetery there across from the institution where there's unmarked graves. So that's rememberEveryName.com. And then the other one is just unlovedoc.com. They should be able to find it.
Unlovedoc.com.
RememberEveryName.com
and UnlovedDoc.com. Well, thank you to you both for spending a little bit of time and helping us to dig a little deeper and to peel back a couple of layers. I wish everyone gets to see, I hope, trust many, many people, everyone, certainly every Canadian gets to see this film. It's an important story. And again, Brian, thanks for your courage and for your willingness to step in, not only today's conversation, but to the film as a whole. And Barry, thank you for the
film. Thank you, David.
We've been talking with Barry Cohen and Brian Logie about the new film, Unloved, Huronia's Forgotten Children, here today on Face to Face. Thanks so much for joining me today. Well, there you have it, my conversation with Barry Cohen and Brian Logie, talking about Unloved, Huronia's Forgotten Children. You can see it on CBC Gem, hopefully coming soon to a digital theater near you. And don't forget, davidpecklive.com for more information about my writing and my speaking. You can pick up a copy of my book there. And you can see close to 600 podcasts. We're about to break across that line. 600 podcasts. That's a lot of conversations that we published here at Face to Face. I hope you've enjoyed some of them. Please go back and look through our library and leave us a review wherever you're listening to podcasts. We would so appreciate it. My name's David Peck. You've been listening to Face to Face.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.